Welcome to the Special Needs Kids Are People Too podcast with Amy Bodkin, EDS. Amy is an autistic adult who also happens to be a school psychologist turned special needs consultant and public speaker. She's also a homeschooling mom to two autistic kiddos, a yoga instructor, a card-carrying Trekkie, and an all-around fun person. And last but not least, Amy is an advocate for seeing every child as a person, not a diagnosis. Because a special needs kid is just like any other child, just more so. Here's Amy Bodkin.
Hi, I'm Amy Bodkin, and welcome to another special episode of Special Needs Kids Are People Too. Today, I am joined by a guest. It is Dr. Rae Stout. She's an audiologist, also autistic like me, only we're different because that's how it is. One autistic person is not like another autistic person.
If you meet one autistic person, you've met one autistic person.
It is so true. But Dr. Rae Stout is here to talk with us. One, we're going to be talking about all of her special interests of what she does. But I want to start out by getting her to answer a question that we had from our recent Q&A. The question is, it's from Amanda. My 9-year-old has a severe phobia around people coughing and clearing their throats. It's isolated us. She's done several therapies to no avail. She does not want anyone in her presence to make those sounds. Everyone tries to avoid it, but it's not always possible. On the other hand, she's super social, gets lonely. I try to get her play dates, etc., but it's exhausting trying to manage the noises that may happen. She wears headphones. My question is, are we hindering her trying to keep the noises away, or do we push her to accept them better? Not like them, but tolerate them. And I thought this was a perfect question to ask you because it really gets into some of the things that you deal with as an audiologist, because it centers around sounds and how we react to them. And I know that it's only a small piece of what you do, but what do you have to say to Amanda about that particular situation from your perspective?
There's two ways people go about dealing with sound sensitivity. And one way is to protect the person from the sound so as to allow the family not to be disrupted. And the other way is to force, typically, the person to be exposed to sounds, like an exposure therapy, so that they will become desensitized, quote unquote. And I'm not a really big believer in either approach. It isn't the tool that's the problem. It's not the headphones per se that I take exception to because I use them myself with my patients. But the difference in what I generally do with my patients coming from an autistic point of view of somebody who is very sensory and at times persistently demanding my autonomy, PDA, as opposed to pathological demand avoidance, I believe in giving children agency. I believe that they have the right to live in their body in a way that they can survive without trauma. And that might mean that sometimes you let them block everything off, but I always want them listening to something because I don't want them becoming so dependent on silence that they actually end up amplifying the world around them. So I like them listening to music. I like them listening to audiobooks. I like them listening to pink noise. Whatever it is that floats their boat and gives them that like third eyelid to be able to blink and protect themselves is fine. I also believe parents should offer visual communication options because sometimes they just cannot, these children cannot communicate effectively using oral communication because it opens them up to the threat of their triggers. And what will happen eventually, from my experience, is that the limbic system becomes less activated, that they're getting stimulation. And like a lot of the music therapies with the vagus nerve, like Safe and Sound Protocol and so forth, by giving them that constant stimulation and that constant ability to connect, whether it's sign language, whether it's cued speech, whether it's using a transcription app on the phone, whether you're writing it on paper, you give them the respect to make their own decision and don't force them into silence or into full exposure. I mean, you wouldn't send a child out into the sun without sunscreen naked. And you wouldn't make them cover up so heavily that they swelter to death. It should be their choice. It is their body. It is their brain. And they know what they need. And eventually, they won't want to have to use these accommodations. I mean, even if they're bothered by their own speech to the point they're using an AAC device or a talker just to not have to talk, eventually they may decide to come out and do something easier, which is talk like everyone else and listen like everybody else until it's too much and they're too overstimulated because they're hungry or they're tired or they're wearing lace socks and they're bothering them and, you know, the itchy tag and their eye is bothering them and their nose is stuffed. And at this point, they are out of spoons. And then they retreat back like an ostrich with the head in the sand. And we should let them retreat. It's their right to choose how to hear.
So as an example, like you were saying with the headphones, so you could play maybe music that you tolerate well through headphones while using like screen reading to be able to communicate with others without getting overwhelmed by the sounds that are too much, but then still getting sound. It's not a completely like sterile, quiet environment either.
It's very important to know that there have been a number of studies, and it goes into the field of hyperacusis, but there's been some studies where they have done double protection, where they use earplugs and headphones on people who have normal systems, you know, or whatever normal is, and not sensitized in that hyperacusis, that hypersensitivity to loud sounds kind of way. And they put them like that for a couple of weeks at a time. It would be akin to my putting you in a dark room with a blindfold and then exposing you to sunlight. And then you get out, I'd say, look, you're bothered by the sunlight. In this case, what we do is, unfortunately, is people say, well, oh, that must mean that these people have hyperacusis because they're temporarily bothered by noise, but they don't have that history of trauma. They don't have that worn-in path in their brain that says, this is painful, you know, or this is scary, and I have to feel anxiety from this because the next thing's going to hurt worse, you know? They don't have that history. They're kind of innocent of it. So when you look at auditory deprivation studies like that one, what you need to realize is that it's not been done on kids that have misophonia. And my point is that, yeah, having that other stimulation is giving them the ability to choose what their sound environment is like. Yeah. And if it's stimulating and it's something they enjoy, they will start associating socialization with positive things. If we force them to only listen to Three Stooges, they probably wouldn't like it very much.
You get tired of anything you listen to for too long.
Are you homeschooling a student or want to be homeschooling a student who learns a little different from the average student? I'd highly recommend checking out a Charlotte Mason Plenary. A Charlotte Mason Plenary is a homeschool company focused on the philosophy of Charlotte Mason. Charlotte Mason was an educational philosopher in the late 1800s, early 1900s, who recognized the importance of not just educating a child body and mind, but also educating them as a whole person with a diet rich in the humanities, the studies of what makes us better human beings. It is not enough to know everything. You also have to know how to use that knowledge in a way that contributes positively to the world. A Charlotte Mason Plenary has all sorts of resources for helping you do Charlotte Mason your way. We also have form guides over there that allow you to plan a customized curriculum in 3 easy steps. And I even partnered with a Charlotte Mason Plenary to create a developmental form guide that goes with these guides that explains to you where to place your child and how to make all sorts of adaptations for different types of learners. Go check it out at cmplenary.com.
Auditory deprivation is a real issue with other patients that I see, and it can be for the misophonia kids too, under these headphones, where the parents, especially autistic kids, where the parents put them under headphones night and day, and there's nothing in the headphone. What people need to realize is that auditory deprivation leads to language delay and auditory processing problems, as well as increased sensitivity to sound, at least temporarily, which then can become traumatic. and then can become much worse and escalate.
Yes, like food, for instance. A lot of times, if we don't like particular flavors, we avoid them. And so then we don't develop a liking for anything similar. But if we start with something similar, then sometimes we can kind of go, oh, hey, you know what? We like this sour flavor. So, you know, let's try this one that's slightly similar, or we don't like the texture, so let's just eat it with a different texture.
I don't know that much about feeding therapy, but I've heard it's a lot like exposure therapy if you're not careful. I know of a very good feeding therapist. And from what I'm understanding, from what I've read anyway, is that you can really traumatize somebody by forcing them to eat things that they don't like. And I can tell you that if you made me eat raw tomato, I might punch you in the face.
But as opposed to exposure therapy or feeding therapy, if we take the relationships that are already positive and give them control,
there's more leeway. If you give them agency of their own body, they're more likely to be willing to have flexibility and experiment. If you force them to do things that make them feel isolated or exposed, then you're going to see that they're going to find safety in routines. They're going to have to stay within this narrow box you've put them in.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I know of several adult autistics. I know one in particular works for a major technology company, like, for example, IBM, which it isn't,
right,
who uses AAC, a talker, to communicate whenever they're tired.
Yeah.
And finds that they're just much less stressed knowing that they have that cave to back into when they need to, that they can have an alternative form of communication. And I believe sign language is a great one. Cued speech maybe has its own strengths. But sign language is a really good one. The talkers are a really good one. There's so many apps now that people can use to communicate. Even if they want to ask an AI a question like, could you explain to my parents A, B, and C with all of the logical reasons, it'll spit out a whole outline that they can agree with or not agree with and email to their parents.
Wow, that is pretty cool.
Like, why I should get to stay up an extra hour now that I'm 17. And let me tell you what I think. And they can actually just talk it into it and it will spit it out. I've been writing an autobiography of being a neurodivergent audiologist and growing up with autism and ADHD and some APD and bipolar. And I'm doing it through AI because of my ADHD. I have a very hard time not thinking in mind maps and going way out onto the branches. You know, like I think about the details and I go really deep into them and then I come back to the trunk and people go, what are you talking about? And I'm like, but I was three strings in. How could you not follow me? I gave you the path. Oh, no, you skipped. But by using those AIs, I can just talk to it for 10 minutes, hit a button and it will organize what I said.
It's like writing with, like, you know, you saw like Prince Harry wrote with another author to write his autobiography. It's the same way, except you're using AI, which is more accessible.
It's incredible. It's an incredible tool for neurodivergence and especially for kids with communication difficulties because it teaches you how to organize your thoughts.
Yes. Yes.
Well, or at least well enough that they will be accepted and you can not organize them. Use how you are. And it'll organize it enough for you that it's acceptable socially.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel the same way about Grammarly with correcting spelling and grammar as I go. It's just that extra tool that's helping you to pull out what you want to pull out of yourself.
So speaking of tools, those headphones, the ones that the child was wearing all the time for misophonia, headphones aren't evil in and of themselves. In fact, I very often will have patients with low gain programmed hearing aids, which are basically Bluetooth earbuds that are custom designed for your hearing that can connect with remote microphones and everything else, tablets, whatever. But they're very discreet and they can also put in some pink noise to reduce some of the input so that you're not as bothered. But if you put headphones on top of those, you can hand a microphone to the person you want to hear and not be bothered by everyone around them. It gives them that control to be able to walk around, have their own mic. This is my ear. I'm pointing to my hand with the microphone in it. This is my ear. And you may not have it if you're going to cough or sneeze. Do you understand? If you think you're going to cough or sneeze, give it back to me or turn it off. And now they only have to worry about one variable.
Yeah. that's a great way of like giving a kid control when normally we don't have that kind of control because we can't have that specialized control of our ears.
And even if they're not doing the microphone, they can play music in it through Bluetooth off a phone or something. And it doesn't look like they're wearing anything. So they don't look like they're cut off from the world. And we can change the ratio of the outside world to the music so that we can cut off everything below a certain amount. So they don't hear as many of those sounds. We don't want to block all of them, though, because then they'll start searching even harder.
Right. So then if they wanted to, like maybe they wanted to be able to get away from using the mic and the headphones, then what we could do is you could slowly increase the noise that is more offensive if they wanted to. Like they'd have control over that, slowly get away from the headphones if it was something they wanted to do. But it's something they have to have control over and choose to do as opposed to somebody else choosing to do it for them.
You know, when you get into the pool and it's the beginning of summer and you don't want to jump in,
right.
You don't want to jump. Why don't you want to jump in?
It's too much of a shock to your system because you haven't done it in a while.
So you can't convince yourself because you haven't done it for a while, but also because it's cold.
Yeah.
So instead you dip your toe in, right?
Yeah.
And you just slowly ease your way in and acclimate. But let's say that across the pool, there was somebody playing with a ball you wanted to join. You might be more motivated to go a little quicker.
Yeah.
So my belief is let's make this entire experience more positive for these kids, where instead of getting progressively more isolated or progressively more forced to expose themselves in uncomfortable or traumatic ways, we give them complete control over their own correction of the problem, and they can choose when to unmask.
I love that it gives them the control over trying to figure out how to do it, but it's a good point to bring up because I think a lot of times we look at these tools and we think, okay, well, we just use the tool all the time, but there's a nuance to using the tool.
Mm-hmm.
We have to not, like, it's not, okay, we want to block out all sounds. No, that's not the goal. We eventually want to be able to interact with sounds theoretically, so let's choose the sounds that we like.
And we know that, for example, Nina Krause is a music in the brain researcher, a neuroscience person at Northwestern University. And what Dr. Nina has figured out, or Dr. Krause has figured out, is that the brain actually changes with exposure to musical training. And one of the things that I always recommend with my patients is that they consider taking up an instrument or learning to sing, even if it's something as simple as buying Simply Sing or Simply Piano. It's the practice, the repetition and the muscle memory and the crossing the midline and the learning to match pitches, because it shows you where you are compared to the pitch so you can match it better. These things are they're known. Musicians' brains are superior to other people's brains. So letting them listen to music that they find calming, music that they find exciting, audiobooks to help them with their language, just kind of guiding them, giving them access to almost as much as you can, unlimited materials that they can experiment with.
Yeah.
So that they can work on those other senses, you know, and maybe you do hypnotherapy, maybe you do ninja training, whatever it is you're doing, you give them ways they can participate fully where the focus is not on the ear. And if they want to be deaf, let them be deaf, but they have to be listening to something. It's their choice of what it is, mm-hmm. but they're not going to sit and listen to silence, no more than a couple hours a day.
Then that sense of hearing is not getting any stimulation. And when we don't mm-hmm. get stimulation, then it causes issues. Like even if it's like muscles, if our muscles don't get proper stimulation, they don't act on the bones correctly and our bones don't grow correctly.
If you don't get, I mean, you've heard the story of Jeannie, haven't you? There was a little girl, mm-hmm. it was back in the 70s, I think, is an abuse story. And it was this little girl who was kept in isolation in a room from the age 2. She was supposedly typical until age 2, and she started getting hip dysplasia or something. The parents were highly abusive and neglectful, and they put her in a room and strapped her to a potty seat until she was 12 years old. And she didn't have access to any language. And all she could see were the shadows moving on the floor. And later, when the scientists found her and pulled her out from that situation, this is a Chomsky kind of stuff where they were trying to look at the critical language age. Like, what is the latest you can teach a person to be a fluent language user? And The answer to that is it starts closing. The window starts really, I know that people like to say that it will never close, but what the research really does show is there might be neuroplasticity to a point later, but once you're about 5 or 6 years old, you already should have all of the sounds in your language pretty well understood.
Right. Getting pruning of the sounds that you don't need.
Yeah, exactly. And if you aren't getting that, if we are isolating our children, even if they have, most of the misophonia kids I've met actually have very good, like better than normal auditory processing. Since the other group I work with is the auditory processing kids and autistic and ADHD, the dyslexic, they tend to be opposite. They're too vigilant. They're like the person who finds the zit on their face and all they can do is squeeze at it until it makes a sore and then keep squeezing at it because they feel so contaminated, like a contamination OCD. But they can pick out those triggers all the way across a house. So there was this little boy, and I actually think the parents may have found me again years and years later because I just got a note. Are you talking about this kid? But, I'd hidden the identity pretty well. But there is a kid who was hearing people sniffle, and he'd be so bothered by that sniffle, he would touch them like he was taking his energy back from them. And then if they did it again once or twice more, he would strike them. And he couldn't stop himself from doing it. It offended him so badly. He felt abused by them. So the teachers, of course, were worried about the safety of the other students. They put him out in the hallway and they handed him worksheets and they left him there for a year to suffer by himself. And he started listening for his triggers, way down the hall to the point that he started hallucinating them. And I tried using pink noise with him. He was my first misophonia patient. I tried using pink noise with him only. And he started just turning the volume up on it to the point that if I gave him any more, I thought I could hurt him. And he started hallucinating his trigger within that pink noise. And I said, at that point, I cannot work with this child. He needs a psychiatrist. He's too anxious. He's been too traumatized. I think I might have done better with him at this point because I wouldn't have limited him just to that sound. I think I would have given him more positive exposures and more ability to block things out instead of just the hearing aids. But at the time, I was very worried about the auditory deprivation, and the microphones weren't very good.
That makes a huge difference today with any kind of processing difference. Our technology has increased to provide us all kinds of opportunities we didn't used to have.
It's incredible that headphones can be, so positive or so negative, and they're the same exact tool. And it's all about the intention of who is in control of the tool.
Yes. Putting the kids in control of the tool because they're the ones who know what's going on in their body and what it feels like.
Absolutely. The hearing aids that I work with, most audiologists, they won't fit children with the hearing aids with that really thin wire. You've seen these because they're convinced they're going to break them. I fit them down to age 4 and 5 sometimes. And I will tell you, we don't see them break very often. The other thing they don't do is they don't give them control of volume control, and they don't give them any manual settings because they assume they're not smart enough or with it enough because they're kids. I give my kids as much control as they will handle. So I have kids. I had a three-year-old. I fit a three-year-old autistic nonverbal kid, and later her twin, who was also autistic, but not till 5. And she was able to go in and out of pink noise settings when she wanted to because she liked to nap with it. And she could change the volume. And, when you talk to this kid now, her speech is going to be as good as mine. But the slightly older one is still an echolalia. I don't know, how far he'll be able to go in terms of language if he's relying only on speech. I think that he's going to really need some alternate ways to communicate. And I think it's because of the age difference of the intervention.
Yeah. And kids are so much more capable sometimes than we like to think as adults. It's like we've forgotten what it's like being kids. But I find a lot of times when we give kids the opportunity to have some control, they are able to do some amazing things. Would you like to tell us a little bit more about some of the things that you do that are outside of just like misophonia, sound sensitivity, and those kinds of things? Because I know that what you do, it's a lot more, there's a lot more depth to it.
Well, I was the first audiologist outside of research to bring low gain hearing aids. Low gain hearing aids or low gain programmed hearing aids are, it's like the headphones. They're regular hearing aids. It's all about how they're programmed. So I was one of the very first people to play with them. And I basically coined the term and popularized the concept of trials with these. People would let people borrow hearing aids, sure. But I do a 6-week, very comprehensive kind of diagnostic trial where I really will go into the patient's environment. Like, let's say they have a basketball game. They're having a hard time hearing in the basketball court. I can have the parent, because I'm 100% virtual, I can have the parent bring their laptop into that environment and make adjustments to the hearing aids right there. Nobody in the world is doing what we're doing in terms of this virtual kind of adjusting, with the exception of there's a couple of hearing aid dispensers that'll do like an initial fitting of something through a computer. But I give the agency back to the patients. I really do. They can see me programming. They understand what I'm doing. They can make suggestions about it. And, you know, we leave the scheduling up to them. It's collaborative partnership. So what we saw when I first started doing this, I was working at an ENT office, and it's, you know, as a mom of two kids who has been ill, it's hard to come up with the kind of funding you need to try out an experiment. But I had seen it already work 5 years before, 2017. I had tried this before, and it had worked amazingly well with a particular patient who I don't have liberty to get into. Mm-hmm. So I decided to try with 10 more kids, but there was no funding. So my son was a baby. So I started buying and selling baby jogger strollers, and I was using a bleach ammonia combination, and it was getting all the mold and mildew off them. And I would buy them around DC and sell them in the suburbs where people would pay a little more. And I raised about $5,000 or $6,000 over a summer, and I fit 10 kids for free. And of that 10, 8 of them did very, very well. And they ended up, I let them buy at cost because I still wasn't fully convinced that what I was seeing was real, you know? So I let them buy a cost, and there happened to be a special going on where it was buy a pair of hearing aids, get a lower level pair of hearing aids for free. And pretty much all of them donated to other patients. So when I first started, people used to say to me, what you're doing is child abuse. You're fitting hearing aids on normally hearing kids. But what the research is showing finally is that what I'm doing is changing the neurology of these kids, because it's helping, they actually can see the differences in brain waves on the kids that have access to FM systems and low gain hearing aids. But the low gain hearing aids are far better, because FM by itself means that you have receivers on the ears and you have a microphone. You're tethered to the microphone all the time. It doesn't work without the mic. The hearing aids do, and they have all the Bluetooth stuff. So they can also have the FM as part of it. So they have huge amounts of flexibility. We're able to take high-pitched sounds and make them like squeeze together so they're less painful and more salient for kids that might have some dyssynchrony in the auditory nerve. We have the ability to adjust low, medium, loud, and the maximum that it can go up to. We're able to measure inside the ears the size and shape of the ear canal through the hearing aids, as well as how the thresholds are at each pitch. And I've seen kids with fluctuating hearing loss where we've been able to just keep an eye on it just through the hearing aid, just bring them back in and keep testing them every couple months and make sure anytime there's a drop, we never let them miss. Or if they have ear infections that are middle ear, why make them miss 2 months of language? Why aren't we fitting these kids, even if it's like an extended trial kind of fitting? Why aren't we fitting these kids so they don't miss that time? We just let them sit until they're ready for tubes. It's like, you know, they're not ripening.
Yeah, no, no, they're not.
So I've fit about, it's over 3,000 kids and adults at this point. And take a guess on how many I've actually seen returned after, not the trial. I wash them out about 30% of the time because of whatever reason, it's not going to work well. But once they've bought and they actually are in a permanent set, I haven't seen one return in 5 years.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, occasionally a teenager will decide they're not willing to wear them anymore. So I have about two, three of them that that happened with over the past year. And we give the parents the ability to give up part of the service plan that they are still paying for and donate the materials, and we'll refit it to another child for free.
That's awesome.
So, and then if they come back, we'll probably find a way to make it more doable because they donated, you
Right,
know.
right.
But I, you know, this community I've created, the auditory processing disorder group that has auditory sensitivities, is 9,400 people. And when I joined the group, I'm not the original owner. When I joined the group, there was 1,200 people, and it's thriving. I mean, we're even having a free ASL class tomorrow night and every Friday.
That's amazing. I really wish we focused more on teaching sign language. Like, I really wish it was something that was required in all preschool and kindergartens.
For dyslexic and auditory processing kids, it should be allowed instead of an oral language.
Yes. And had more kids learning it, they would understand how to use it better. People could communicate and not be blocked from communicating with other people in their same country.
I agree. I mean, I don't love the option, but the fact that you can use a program like iHear or Otter AI, and at least you can use that to transcribe things that you're not hearing or functioning. But I think that the language itself, ASL, is the language of my heart. I mean, I've been signing since I was 3 years old, and I think that it's so important to have access to it. My elementary school, middle school, high school, we had interpreters in every class. I don't think I would have gotten through school if we hadn't had interpreters.
And it has so much utility. I mean, with my own daughter, it helped her learn to be able to connect that words have meaning. I know you were saying that sign language could be also used for benefits with dyslexic kids.
Well, from what I understand, because it can give 3D, the understanding of 3D motion and stuff, it tends to help build areas of the brain that help with reading and moving letters around. There's another system called cued speech, which is used that's phonetic. And what's nice about cueing is you can learn it in about a day or two. I learned it in chemistry class in about 2 hours. It was
Wow.
boring. The chemistry class.
Right.
And I grew up with kids that used sign language, that used cued speech. And I will tell you this, deaf signers on average will attain a third to fourth grade reading level if they don't have a strong parent that signs to them, or they don't go to a deaf school because they don't have good language. It would be like my teaching you Russian and then asking you to write in Mandarin, you know?
Right.
So the cuers are being taught English. So they're learning diphthongs, they're learning vowels, they're learning how words break apart. So when they talk, they know English first. So most of the kids I knew growing up who cued also did sign, you know, because signing is so much fun. It's a great way to have conversations. But because of the cueing, their literacy rates were off the chart, and they all went to schools like Cornell and Columbia and UNC, and all of them got masters and doctorates, except for one kid who had charge syndrome who still got an associate's.
Well, and that would make sense that that would be a particular, well, be in a particular need in that community, because if you can't hear the sounds, then you have to do that.
Memorize whole words, which is a terrible way to learn to read.
Exactly.
So cued speech and Orton Gillingham was looked at by a woman named Jennifer Montgomery. She took, I think it was five or six deaf dyslexic children and taught them both to see what would happen compared to either system alone. And she found it was they actually managed to keep up for like a year of instruction. They made a year of growth, which is unheard of in that population.
Wow, that's really exciting.
Cueing is an incredible learning tool. And I think it should be a universal intervention as well as the signing.
But you know, I think that a lot of times when we really, if we would actually look at and learn to appreciate the differences that exist between all of us, it really opens up and expands our world so that we have more opportunities because. You know, cueing is used a lot of times with children who are trying to develop reading skills that are deaf, but previously they hadn't thought about it for dyslexia. But
Yeah.
that's a great idea. And
And it costs nothing.
yeah.
And if you did it in the beginning, the kid wouldn't need help. I mean, I can't say that for sure, but it's a very, I mean, it's something, I mean, the whole thing fits on an index card. You could learn it so easily. Why aren't we offering this?
Yes.
So anyway, within my practice, we talk about all of these things. And my practice basically is the Facebook group. I hook people up with professionals that can teach cueing, could teach signing. I have some OTs in there and speech pathologists that I'll very often refer to. One of the main issues, they don't have licensure all over the country.
Right. That is a problem.
I have 48 of the 50 states myself, which has been very hard to get. We even had a car crash in Texas in a snowstorm and totaled trying to get to Las Vegas, trying to get a license. It's a lot of time. I have a staff member who spends most of her time on my certifications.
I bet. It's incredibly difficult. It's part of the reason I chose to work as a consultant instead of working, doing diagnosis and stuff anymore.
So Oh, yeah.
It's a huge challenge. Now, tell us again what the name of the Facebook group is so that parents can find you.
It's the Auditory Processing Disorders, and it says APD, and there's a slash CAPD, like Auditory Processing Disorder slash Central Auditory Processing Disorder, and Auditory Sensitivities Group.
Awesome. And can you go ahead and tell us a little bit about where else they can find you in case they want to find out more? And I think we definitely have to have you back at some point because we should talk about literacy as well, because there's so many like wonderful topics, and to have them from the perspective of an audiologist and especially an autistic audiologist, because let's be honest, when we get our special interests, we take a super deep dive.
That's right.
So if you want a really good something, whatever it is you're looking for, if you can find an autistic who loves it, they're going to be good. Generally speaking.
My website is drraestout.com. So drraestout. .com. I would say the best way to get to know me is to go in there, join that Facebook group, read some of the articles that I've written, which are all over that group. If you're curious to hear more about what I've done specifically, I find the best keywords are thanks, Dr. Ray.
Oh, that's awesome. I like that. And it's easy to remember.
And I always encourage people to post questions. I'll tell you, somebody posted up a question about, what do you think about Dr. Ray in this particular area? And someone said, my kid's not wearing his hearing aids anymore, and I'm really frustrated. And I said, you know, here's the thing. We have to accept negative feedback. And we have to be, you know, I see it as being fortunate enough to know there's a need that I can go back and contact that person and try to figure out what we can do to rectify the situation, because maybe she wasn't brave enough to say something.
Absolutely.
Most people are happy.
Yes, it's true. It's true. I've found the same thing. If you've done the deep dive into your topic, like this is your deep dive, this is your special interest, then generally speaking, the support you provide is really good. And if there's a problem, if people will say something, then that's something we can problem solve and fix. Mm-hmm. If they don't say anything, then it's hard to fix it.
I think the main thing is to give people agency over their own hearing healthcare, over their own bodies. And I think that open communication, we need to stop taking negative feedback as being anything other than somebody asking for help.
Right.
It's not a comment on your character if something didn't work.
Right. I find that this is also why, like, I've started working more with homeschool families as well as a couple other specialists. I know an OT, a speech therapist. It's because homeschool families in general, they love a good DIY project. Like, give them the tools, they are going to make it happen.
And we see, I would say that I probably see homeschool families 50 to 60% of the time, and they are the best to deal with.
They really, like, you give them the tools, they will make things happen. And so I love the idea of being able to bypass systems that sometimes help us and give the information that's needed to the parents who can really make use of it.
I mean, IEPs are well and good, but really the best IEP is a homeschool situation if you can do it. I personally am not a particularly good teacher. If I was ever going to do homeschool with my children, I'd probably have to hire a teacher to teach, because I just, it's just not in my toolbox.
Like, being, you know, all parents are facilitators of their children's needs. So with homeschooling, you can be the teacher, but you can also be the facilitator. I'm facilitating your needs. I'm putting you in touch with a teacher for this subject or a teacher for that subject or the right book or the right video or whatever.
You know, and I think we do that naturally. But I think for me anyway, I probably would need something like the artificial intelligence probably would help quite a bit, because you can actually say, I want to teach A, B, and C. How can I do that best with a child who has these preferences? And it'll actually come up with suggestions.
That is an interesting idea as well, because if an AI had enough information about how a child learns well, and then you told them what you were wanting to teach, that could be a useful tool.
Well, as far as I understand, because you sign in with your email address, mm-hmm. Creepy as it is or not, they're keeping a memory of what you've asked in the past. Like this autobiography I'm writing, I'm able to go in there and say, remember how I said this? I'd like to add this part. Can you rewrite it?
It's amazing and creepy too at the same time, but still amazing.
You know what? Maybe AI is one of our children.
I try to remember that anytime I get a phone call from a telemarketer. Be as kind as possible.
Yeah, it's hard.
Mm-hmm. It is.
It's hard.
I just want to talk to a person who can answer my question. But, I think that this really, kindness is so important, especially with differences, whether it is a difference with how a child perceives sound, how someone learns best or takes in information, or also maybe it's someone who's not like you, or maybe it's an AI or whatever, but kindness and, you know, an interest in developing a relationship and learning how we bridge that gap is so incredibly important, I think. So
I would agree. You have to see the other person as a person.
Yes. Yes. Which is what this podcast is all about. Special needs kids are people too. Thank you, Dr. Ray, for joining me today. And I look forward to having you back at some point, because there's so many fascinating topics that we could go into from an audiology perspective. And it's definitely not my specialty. So I love getting to deep dive with someone where it is their specialty. Thanks for being with us today, guys, and we'll see you next time.
We hope you had fun listening to today's episode and gained some new insights into the wonderful variety of people in our world. You can find out more about Amy's advocacy work at amybodkin.com. And remember, special needs kids are people too.